Welcome to the Mumbrella Cast, sponsored by cradiodifferently.com. I'm Robin Hicks.
And I'm Colin Delaney. This week,
Dan Illick in Afghanistan.
A small bit in the back of your mind that goes, did you know that like 30 people died in a Chinook crash just 2 weeks ago?
Drug 5 makes its Woolies debut.
You may think I work for Woolworths, but I don't. I work for them.
Is Hollywood a necessary evil?
Drunk kebabs and sexy trains.
And director Alex Proyas might get to make a movie after all. So with us today in the studios of CBS Interactive is Dan Illick, comedian, writer, presenter, filmmaker, and not to be outdone of job titles, Cathy McGinn, Mumbrella's multimedia and marketing journalist. Hello, guys.
Hello. Hello. Good to be with you.
So, welcome to the podcast, Dan. As we mentioned, you're a man of many hats. You wear too many different things. What do you find yourself leaning towards of late?
Kind of, it depends where the gig's at. And so generally I'm trying to do writing and performing and comedy. That's kind of my thing. And then what I'll do as a fallback career is direct television commercials and direct social video stuff and create social video stuff and work on digital strategy for brands that want to do things differently outside of an agency system.
Yeah. So what do you find is bringing in the bacon at the moment? What's the sort of staple bread and butter work?
Definitely social video stuff. That's really massive at the moment, and have a lot of fun doing it, and been doing it for 6-7 years now. So I'm kind of one of the older one of the people that's been doing social video stuff for a long time, and that's been great. So I really like taking. I don't have many brands, but I like taking small brands and taking them on the net with decent sized budgets to make entertainment. Delight the audiences of the internet, pretty much. And that's pretty much bread and butter. And then television I almost do for charity. quite frankly, that's what happens when you work at the ABC. After 3 seasons of working at Hungry Beast, I saved up enough Andrew Denton enough wrote books to build myself a house. So it's really exciting. That's how they pay you. They pay you in ABC merchandise. Yeah. But then, working at shows on Channel 10 is not much different. I'm not a big star, so I'm not getting heaps of money an episode to do stuff like Can of Worms and things like that. So, it's kind of what truly is really good for me is I can do a bunch of social video stuff, go away, write some creative projects. And then kind of use the branded content stuff to fund creative stuff, fun stuff.
It almost sounds like, for most people, they would think that the TV stuff is where the money comes in.
Totally, definitely. No, that's exactly what happens. So people, my friends, my parents of my friends will come up to me and go, you're doing very well for yourself. We saw you on Kerry Ann. Yeah. And you go, that was $300 that's gonna buy me lunch this week. So that's good. That's why I do it. So, yeah. It's all a perception thing. People think that if you're on TV, you earn a lot of money, which is not true. If you're on radio, you make shit ton of money.
Mm. you mentioned social video.
Yeah.
Is it getting easier using this medium, it's a fast-growing medium, to get your message out there, to get discovered for emerging artists, for emerging talent, to make itself heard?
Definitely, particularly if you've got a good idea. Basically, if you've got a great idea, that's going to transcend any kind of marketing plan or digital strategy you want to put through, you want to put forward to kind of promote an idea. I get really annoyed with clients who go, yeah, great, we're going to spend 10 grand on a video and we're going to spend 45 grand on digital strategy to push it out there. It's going to be really great. I'm like, that's inverse. You shouldn't be doing that. You should be spending 45 grand on production and ideas, mostly. Production could cost anything to make a social video. Could cost $5. But the ideation is probably where the money should go. Yeah. Certainly not trying to spam your brand's Facebook page with it because it's not going to trend. Yeah. It's easy now. It's also a more cluttered market compared to 5 years ago. Mm. When you look at 2006, when YouTube first came about, you got all these great breakout stars, but now a lot more needs to happen for you to kind of break out.
Yeah, exactly. It's not always predictable.
No, it's a dark art.
One idea will spread. Or do you think there is a formula to it? Can you spot an idea and think, as we can with Mumbrella, sometimes we get story ideas and we think, that's a 100-comment story.
Yep.
We know our readers.
Yep.
We know what they like to read,
yep.
Discuss.
Yep.
Is there a formula to a good idea that will spread?
Not really. There's no set formula. But having said that, there are some things that I kind of love to tap into. I kind of want to tap into a conversation that's happening online, and I kind of want to be able to delight the audience. So I want to entertain the audience. That's my first and foremost thing. So that's why, as opposed to an agency, I'm not an agency. I'm an entertainer. And what I want to do with my social videos is really entertain audiences. And I'm not that keen on a branding message. If it works, then it's good. But first and foremost, I'm looking for a way to tap into a conversation. That's the big thing. If you can tap into a grander conversation, then your idea is going to travel further.
So can you explain about Irrational Fear and how that works as a live format?
Yeah, Irrational Fear is a live hour-long radio show, but it's also a live show at the FBI Social. And it's really fast. It's really funny. We've got a whole bunch of Sydney's best comedians. We're just kind of looking at the truth behind the news kind of thing. And the kind of slogan for Irrational Fear is that there's always something to be scared of. And we're just kind of hyping up. It's kind of like a media analysis, political analysis show. And it's really great. So this week we've got Veronica Milsom and Lewis Hobber from Hungry Beast, and we've also got Chris Taylor from The Chaser, Scott Abbott, who's a great comedian from Melbourne, he's from Political Asylum in Melbourne, and we've got Mark Colvin from PM, he's our special guest, and we're actually going to be talking to him about his illness, which he's got, and kidney transplants, and so that's going to be really interesting. So it's a kind of a mix of really funny stuff, and then we kind of have a small serious moment, but we hope to kind of have a serious moment and lots of jokes at the same time. So it's just, yeah, it's really great. Last month we had Kamal on. We tried to get Jay Legai to talk about his tweets about his ethnic tweets. He was saying he got the sack from Home and Away, and he said Home and Away can't afford to have more than two ethnic characters at once on Home and Away, which is pretty funny. And he got a little bit of hate on him about that. So I called him up and was like, Jay, why don't you come and do Irrational Fear? Let's make fun of this situation and make fun of Australian media and how white it is. He's like, yeah, that's a great idea. That's awesome. And then his agent called up and was like, Dan, Jay won't be doing that. you know, 2 days after that, I was at the Chaser rap party for The Unbelievable Truth, and Kamal was there. And I was like, Kamal, wrote this sketch for Jay Legaia. He didn't want to do it. Do you want to do it? He's like, is it a freebie? I was like, it is. Okay. So I had Kamal pretend to be Jay Legaia talking about Australian media. So the beautiful opening line is like, hello, you may recognize me from my many roles in Home and Away and Star Wars. It's really, really great. So, yeah.
You mentioned fear, which is quite a big topic in the creative industry. Fear is something that can stunt the creative process, stunt brave ideas. In your line of work, how do you deal with fear in terms of, you know, when you're putting together an idea, putting together a performance? How do you cope with fear?
Well, you can't. After a while, you kind of get used to it. There's fear when you're kind of creating work that's a little bit edgy and topical, because there's an economy of outrage at the moment, and this has kind of been the trend of the last 5 years. Is, you know, you put something out there, then the media will find somebody that doesn't like it, and then inflate a bubble of outrage, and then have that outrage bounce back and forth across the media dialogue. So when we do create edgy work, the cool thing for a comedian is, A, you can tap into that yes, outrage and really make that work for you, which is what I do often with my work, but also to kickstart a conversation. But also, it can also backfire on you, and it can go too far, and media outrage can, you know, call for your death pretty much.
Yes.
Well, one I will bring up is the MTV Cribs that you did for...
Get Up,
yes. Let's just take a quick listen.
G'day, I'm David Hicks. Welcome to my crib. Come on, check it out. My evil neighbour, Zakara Mesh. Hello, Zakara Mesh. He's all right. This is the here. 312. I asked for 911, but they wouldn't give it to me. This corner. This is good corner. This is where I spent 2003 and 2002. I spent 2 years there. This corner here, this is my holiday corner. Just my time. Really? when we're getting tortured, we have to wear a hood and stuff, but not me. Thanks to Dad, he got me a Coles bag to wear. Hey! Much more environmentally friendly than those other hoods. But you know what? It's not all good. I get bored a lot. So much so, I pretend I'm on Big Brother.
It's time to go. David Hicks.
Hey, that's me. Oh, my
God. On YouTube,
yep.
That's got a bit of... You've got a bit of hate going on. But then again, that comes with YouTube territory, I guess, is hate. So do you think that I mean, I thought it was fantastic.
Yeah.
It's very funny. It's a good contradiction sort of thing. Did the Get Up guys like it?
They loved it. So how that piece came about, there's a great story about how that piece came about. It's 2006. I was on a plane coming back from LA. I was sitting next to a guy with shaved head and blue jeans and white sneakers. I was like, that guy's American. I recognize him from somewhere. And then I turned to him across the aisle. I was like, excuse me, are you David Hicks's lawyer? He's like, yeah.
Amazing.
Yeah, Michael, I'm Dan Mori. Nice to meet you. How are you? And I started showing him all my work. He's like, great, Dan. That's great. You should do something for us. And I was like, oh, well, Get Up have just started and they've kind of asked me to do stuff. Like, great, you should do something with Get Up and do something for us. And so that sketch was initially a sketch I wrote for the Ronnie John's Half Hour on Channel 10, and it got shot down as being unkind. But I thought it was hilarious. I thought it was just too funny not to do. So I went and made it for Get Up. It cost like $800, and it did like 150,000 hits in a week on for Get Up, and it raised about 40 grand for them to continue their campaigns. This is the very early days of Get Up as well. That was a lot of money for them back then. Since made a lot of other campaigns that have made a lot more money. I should have had shares in the money, points in the money, rather than get a fee from GetUp. So when you do create a bit of work like that, that's great. And the kind of hate you're going to get from that, of course you're going to get hate from people who don't like Americans. Of course you're going to get hate from people who think you're making fun of Muslims who are incarcerated in Afghanistan and Guantanamo Bay, and that just comes with the territory. If you're gonna play in an area that's kind of a bit tetchy, as long as you've got truth on your side, then you're fine. I made a joke. I do a joke in my stand up that never goes down well, but I love it because it's based on truth. My last name is Illich. I say Illich because when I was growing up in the 90s. That was when the Yugoslav war was on and my last name's Serbian. So I kind of do this joke where I say, I call myself Illich because let's face it, the Serbs were the Nazis of the 90s. They had all the cleansing but none of the dress sense. And that joke always gets groans in the audience. People think that I'm saying something different than I'm not. But what I'm saying is, the Serbian army, they ethnically cleansed a race of people. And they wore bum bags. That's what I'm saying. So people are ultra-sensitive.
A crime in itself.
Crimes against fashion. I think the UNHCR doesn't have a department for that. And they still don't, clearly. So people are just really ultra-sensitive to stuff in that territory. But because that joke, I maintain, is truthful and it's got history behind it, it's a good joke.
And
made Bob Carr laugh when I did it at a charity gig once.
You were recently in Afghanistan to entertain the troops, much like Bob Hope or...
I was actually in Afghanistan to fix the war.
Sorry.
We all went tits up.
Before we jump in to discuss your experiences, let's take a quick listen.
We're about to hop on a Chinook and go to Tarancow. I've just been informed there's a giant mountain over there, but we can't see it because there's that much dust in the air. I'm going to be riding with you and John Schumann, a couple of boys, to Tarancow in one of these. Unbelievable. This place is so huge.
The Chinook is like the delivery van for the army, flying in pairs, scraping across the Afghan desert. We picked up US soldiers, dropped US soldiers off, picked up some more US soldiers and dropped them off. We then flew air support for the other Chinook as they went down and picked up some Aussie troops to give them a lift up a mountain.
I play like a lot of first-person shooter computer games, and so it was very exciting to be part of something like that. But in the back of your mind, there's a small bit in the back of your mind that goes, did you know that like 30 people died in a Chinook crash just 2 weeks ago? Yeah, it was shot down. Did you know that? Yep, I didn't know that.
Multinational base Taran Kaut is where most of the Australians are based in Afghanistan. It's set at the bottom of some pretty spectacular and dangerous mountains. The gig we did there was one of the best in my entire life. It was the most emotionally charged crowd I've ever performed to. 700 personnel from all over the world crammed in to watch the show. The next morning, we were up early because there was blowing up to be done.
Guys, if you need a hand with anything, I play a lot of Call of Duty. I just got one question. Where do you respawn?
So you...
That's one of my favourite bits.
Genius. Sweet edit. You compiled that web series for Fairfax Digital, is that correct?
Yeah.
Yeah, so tell us about your experience going over there to fix the war.
Oh, wow, it was incredible. Just a really amazing experience. I really wanted to do this for a long time. I've got two brothers in the army, so it's kind of cool. Like, my oldest brother went to Iraq. My youngest brother spent did a tour in Afghanistan. And my other brother is a Qantas pilot, and then I make dick jokes. So it's not like I have a very good job at all compared to them. So it's really nice to be able to go over and kind of see what they see and kind of experience what they experience in their jobs. And what they do is incredibly tough compared to what I do. So it was really nice just to go and check that out firsthand and kind of understand a bit where they're coming from when they're telling stories at Christmas and Easter time. but just amazing. Like, there's nothing over there. When you hear about the stats of Afghanistan about how 90% of the GDP is boosted by foreign aid, you can absolutely tell. The only things that are there are mud huts and shipping containers. And the shipping containers just are everywhere. The inbuilt politic of construction in Afghanistan is based around the shipping container. There's just buildings made out of shipping containers that are all bricked in, but they use shipping containers as a base, and it's all dusty. There's just nothing there, and it's incredible that we're there at all. And I can understand the idea of kind of what's called COIN, counterinsurgency tactics, in order to kind of build up the Afghan army to take over. But what's kind of happening at the moment is a crazy malaise, and I don't. Like, having been there and feeling what the troops are feeling, there's a certain thing when someone is on deployment in Afghanistan. I noticed talking to troops that are there, their Australian troops go for 8 months, American troops go for 12 months, which is crazy. So about 4 months in, Australian troops are like happy to be there. They're enjoying it. It's their job. That's why they're there. That's why they join the army, to do something like that. And then the closer they get to going home, like a month out, there's this anxiety that really attacks them, and they just are just aching to get home. And like within 2 weeks, that there's a 2 week period where it just is absolutely crazy because they just want to get out.
And what sort of jokes do you tell them?
Your mama jokes. girls versus boys. You know, what's the deal with the Taliban? You know, that kind of stuff. Oh, I tried to do as much research as I could. So I actually went down and interviewed my brother and asked him what kind of jokes I should tell. And he's like, oh, you make fun of the officers, make fun of acronyms. So I was like, I was writing all this down furiously. And you know, say the C word as often as you can. They love that stuff. there's a bit in the series where my brother says, what you got to do is you go to the welfare hut where they have telephones for people to call back and internet terminals for people to call back. And on the walls of the welfare hut is pretty much the only place where a soldier can show insubordination. It's where they write up graffiti and they say all sorts of awful things about people they work with. Like Gareth is a fag and like the CO is a cum spray. And next to that, there'll be like 15 ticks, you know. And so he said, just write it down and read it out. I was like, what? Yeah, just write it down and read it out. I was like, okay, great. So one of the most gratifying things I did was spend half an hour going from booth to booth in the welfare hut just writing down the funniest stuff I saw.
and just
reading it out verbatim.
A friend of mine went over to both Afghanistan and Iraq as a journo. And he kind of, there was some controls put on what he could and couldn't write, I believe, where he could go and that sort of thing. Mm. I mean, how, as a comedian, Were such rules put on you?
No, the army people were really great. Everyone I dealt with at the army was great. Army media were terrific. They just said, "Oh, you can't show that aerial. You can't show that weapon. You can't show, this box, which is like a secret box. You have to blur that out." And I was like, "Oh, amazing!" And like, they didn't stop any soldiers were complaining to me on camera, and they didn't stop any of that stuff. They went through all of my footage and cleared it all except for maybe four shots.
Wow!
So I was so thrilled, and I was so pleased, and that they were like that. They're really cool.
And did you go over as a guest of
Forces Entertainment? Yeah.
Right,
so okay. I went over as a guest of the army. And it's not as a comedian. It's not my position to be an investigative reporter and try and find out what's going on with the war. My job is there to entertain the troops, and what I wanted to try and find out is get an empathetic view of what it's like on the ground as a troop, as someone deployed.
Dan, you also run Downwind Media, which is involved in entertainment and advertising. Some recent projects you can tell us about?
Just finished a series of sketches for Game TV. So this is a social video side of the business. We're pitching on a bunch of work at the moment. Previous to that, did a whole big series for Vic Rhodes, which Mumbrella covered, and gave a very lovely review to. So thank you guys, really appreciate that. I do a lot of work with GetUp through Downwind Media. GetUp is one of my big clients, so we kind of work together on the creative. It's basically it's a creative house. So it's me as a producer, director, writer, and then when there's budgets, I pull in every comedian in Sydney to work on.
And is it largely comedic stuff that you're going for?
It depends what it is. So we've got it depends on the client as well. Mm. So for something something Motion Picture Company, which is the production company side of the business, did recently was a big piece for GetUp, which is about gay marriage. It was a lovely first person.
It's Time. Yeah,
It's Time. It's great. The It's Time video. So that's something that Motion Picture Company did, and so that's obviously not funny, but it was really great to make and really, really hard to make. And that was kind of what's great about working with a client like GetUp is we work really fast because it's production company and client. And when it's production company and client and there's good creative people in both, good stuff happens. And that's why it's really thrilling to work with clients direct. Dealing with agencies is the worst.
Why? How so?
It's the worst. It's like another layer between people who've got to make the idea. Who call the idea, and one day, a day soon, it's going to be production company client, and agencies can fuck right off.
Controversial.
Having said that, we do a lot of work with agencies, and they're really great to work with.
And how about Can of Worms? Will you be returning, despite Dicko not returning?
Dicko is going to be returning, but not as host. So he it's his format. So he's going to be hanging around and helping out and telling us what to do. So yeah, it's good. It's good. I will be returning. That's all I know.
Next, Droga 5's first ad for Woolies.
There's more to radio than music through your headphones. Radio can connect your brand with consumers in more ways than just over the airwaves. Check out the case study for Nissan Microcitizen, where listeners were sent to LA, Barcelona and New York to get in sync with the city. Or the interview on how the Lady Gaga deal for Vodafone All-Time Prepaid was done. See that and more at seeradiodifferently.com.
This week, Woolworths launched its first ad from Droga 5. It's a campaign that promotes its own label, Woolworths Select. Let's take a listen.
This is not just any jam. This is Australian made. Tested and tasted again and again by Woolworths selectors just like me. 102, E120 and 416, all gone. In fact, added preservatives, artificial colours and flavours, viscosity, texture, taste must all be perfect. Otherwise, it's no. Start again. You may think I work for Woolworths, but I don't. I work for them.
If it's not selected by you, it's not selected by us. Woolworths Select.
It's not a bad ad to poach the own label name of another supermarket. It's kind of no frills while still having that Droga feel. But, Robin, yeah, a few people in our comment thread said it is very Droga. Do certain agencies have their own certain style.
Yeah, I think with Droga 5, it's very much a fashionable agency. It's cool to work at Droga. Supposedly, they produce sort of cutting-edge, interesting work. And for them to take on a massive advertiser like Woolworths is, you know, people have said it will destroy their culture. They'll become uncool because of this massive client they're going to have to take on.
I think one of the names that was coming up in the comment thread was Droga 4.499.
Yeah, because they're now doing retail. So, and it's interesting to see. This is their first outing. It's not the edgiest thing I've ever seen, but at least it's not supermarket sing-alongs and, you know, butchered old classics like Coles are doing.
Thank God they don't have a hand pointing down. That's really great.
This is it. At least it's something that has a creative idea. At least it's something that's moving on from the Woolies ads of the past that have been, frankly, pretty terrible. Dan, also, if you've seen the ad, I just wonder what you make of it versus the stuff that's gone before.
Well, I'm biased because Kate Worsley is a good friend of mine who plays the lead talent, and she was in the film I made Y2K, and we went to the uni together, and I think she's brilliant. I thought it was really great, and I think I was really sceptical about seeing basically how the big Woolworths chain is going to come in and undercut everybody again. But I was like, oh, that's a nice ad. I feel like some jam. I think it's great. I think it's great that there's something interesting. I think it's. I'm glad it's not like a standard fresh food people gear. Mm.
Do you think an arty approach suits a supermarket that's all about mass appeal?
Well, I think something. Look, as someone that consumes television commercials, I think something different is something that's going to be interesting, and I think that's kind of interesting.
Robin, tell us about the former agency that had Woolworths was M&C Saatchi. What is their style compared to Droga's?
Well, without wanting to generalise about M&C Saatchi, it's one of the biggest agencies in Australia, but they're so big because they've had such big retail clients. They knock out fairly cheaply produced mass appeal ads. That's their speciality, and they've been doing it for Woolworths for 10 years. Now comes along this hot shop, and supposedly it's going to change radically. But we haven't seen that yet, but I think it's an interesting sort of first step forward.
I always laugh when I hear about people commenting on ads and stuff, because when you work in television and like sketch comedy, you have to churn out a chunk of ideas. You have to churn out 45 minutes of ideas every week. And the idea that a 30 second TVC is going to take 3 months of development and rewriting 1,000 times just to get just right, and then it ends up like, who gives a shit? Like, come on. I can't believe people take this so seriously.
It can sometimes be frustrating when you see the quality and the budget that goes into a 30 second yeah. slot when, you know, as when films are struggling to right. be made, you know, 90-minute films are struggling to be made on the same amount of budget.
That's right.
But the comments so far on our Mumbrella thread are pretty 50-50 whether or not, you know, our readers like it.
Half of those people work at Droga, saying, well,
the other half,
what a great job it is. Half those people work at M.C. Saatchi.
Rubbish.
I love the Mumbrella comments because about three people comment under their real name, and I think that's good. That's honesty in advertising, exactly. Right there.
Exactly.
When you were with Hungry Beast, one of the Beast Files was all about Coles versus Woolies and the way their own brands were putting a squeeze on local farmers. Let's take a listen.
This is Woolworths Limited, and this is Wesfarmers. You know them as Woolies and Coles, the big friendly giants, the number one and two retailers in Australia. 23 cents of every dollar we spend ends up in their pockets. More than just Woolies and Coles, they own a range of supermarkets. They also own variety stores, electronics outlets and hardware chains, as well as many of the places you buy alcohol. And not just Bottle-O's, Woolies has a 75% stake in 270 pubs and clubs, and Coles is catching up with 91. That's a lot of poker machines. Woolies alone operate 12,000 of them. The giants also sell fuel through deals with Caltex and Shell, and Wesfarmers owns coal mines in three states. But their core business is still groceries. Together, they share more than 70% of the Australian market. The UK's two biggest chains share 48%. The US equivalents are mere 20. The giants flex their competitive muscles in a number of ways. They gradually buy out smaller rivals in a process called creeping acquisitions. They also buy land their competitors might be interested in, and leave it vacant, a tactic known as greenfield acquisitions. In 2008, an ACCC inquiry found evidence of more than 700 restrictive covenants. Deals made by Woolies and Coles with shopping malls to keep out rivals such as Aldi and IGA. The Giants agreed to phase out this anti-competitive practice, but hundreds of the contracts remain. The Giants have also been accused of predatory pricing, using their huge buying power to push prices down, driving smaller competitors out of business, at which point they're free to raise prices again. And they don't just squeeze their rivals, they squeeze their suppliers too. The National Farmers Federation claims farmers are getting as little as 5% of what you pay at the checkout. Finance commentator Robert Gottliebson describes this as one of the greatest scandals ever seen in this country. Despite a recent ACCC inquiry into pricing competition backing the Giants, farmers groups are now calling for a royal commission. Last year, Woolies and Wesfarmers made over $100 billion in revenue. They spend millions of that marketing themselves as caring Australians. Yet our grocery prices are up 41% since 2000. That's 8% higher than the OECD average. But if you want to protest by shopping elsewhere, good luck. Woolies and Coles have 6,500 stores. Despite protests from some communities, that number keeps growing. Woolies and Coles, our big friendly giants. As the Coles ads tell us, every dollar counts.
So that was from the now finished Hungry Beast. Why did Andrew Denton call it quits?
Why did Andrew Denton call it quits? Well, Kathy, that's a question for Andrew Denton. I'm not going to rule it in or rule it out. No, Andrew Denton didn't call it quits. Andrew would have loved to have gone again. You got to ask the ABC why they didn't want to do it. And I suspect Hungry Beast is a expensive show to make, and that's and they'd rather spend that money making Outland. Or something else.
There was some great talent that came out of the Hungry Beast crew, the alumni, if you will. Where has some of these key guys ended up?
Everybody's kind of dispersed, but we're all kind of connected digitally through our digital ghetto that we've set up for ourselves, which is nice. People are everywhere. You've got Ali Russell, who's working as a producer at Sunday Night, which is a big culture shock for her. And then you've got Mon Shafter, who has won a Walkley and is now working at 7:30. Aaron Smith is a DOP that I work with all the time, and he's just finished shooting Country Town Rescue, and he's finished shooting something for Cordell Jigsaw Zapruder called Dumb Drunk Racist, which will be on ABC 2, which is great. Jess Mendes is at ABC 24. Everybody's kind of dispersed in the media now. It's really great. And, of course, if you're on Twitter, you'll know where Mark Finelli is all the time. he's absolutely everywhere. And I'm jumping between every commercial network, doing lots of different things and freelancing absolutely anywhere and anywhere that wants to pay me. And then also working on larger projects as well. So it's kind of really interesting. Like, we've all kind of managed to get jobs, kind of media-based jobs, but just kind of spread out, you know, not working together as such. But Lewis Hobber and Veronica Milstrom at Triple J doing breakfast on the weekends, and Scott Mitchell is at Dateline. The only one that's kind of a big question is Kirk Docker. Kirk, from what I understand, is designing shorts and putting on an aerobics night and a yoga night and playing handball, lots of handball.
He's turned his back on media.
Yeah, no, but he hasn't. He's actually been working. He's been doing all of that, but he's also been working at Fairfax as well as video journalist. So we've kind of dispersed, but still kind of playing in public domain.
Next, the Hollywooditis of Australian drama.
So this week we posted an opinion piece originally published in Encore by Bevan Lee, who created both Pack to the Rafters and Winners and Losers. He said young actors were too eager to make it big in Hollywood and departing Australian shows for LA before the programmes had run their course. He said, and I quote, "Were I creating Packed to the Rafters now, I doubt I would have used the word packed in the title. It certainly exacerbates the current problem created by the actors playing the Rafters' children heading for La La Land en masse." As a result, Lee was creating concepts with either shorter lives or concepts able to shift the character focus without unsettling the audience. So Dan, I don't know if you read the piece, but what are your thoughts on this in principle? Do we suffer from the actor's version of brain drain?
Actors are horrible people, aren't they? Why would you star in a movie with Will Ferrell when you can do 7 episodes back-to-back of Sea Patrol? Why would you do that? That's a very good question. Actors are horrible people trying to advance their careers and do interesting work when the work's available. Oh, boo-hoo. Fucking packed to the rafters. Why don't you fucking write some jokes or make something interesting? How about that?
Fantastic rant. To be fair to Bevan Lee, he did say he completely understands why the actors would take off.
Jess McNamee is a friend of mine, and she's been in LA every pilot season for the last few years, and then coming back to do Pack to the Rafters. This last 2 times, she hasn't come back to do Pack to the Rafters because she's been doing feature films with Rachel McAdams. So it's incredible. Like, what you can be what I like to call an AFL kind of star. You know, you can either play the AFL or you can be a rock star. It's incomparable.
Mm.
Like, I don't understand. I understand where he's coming from. He wants an actor to hang around. Ray Maher's been around. He hasn't gone off to LA.
Yeah. I think one of the other points he was making was that he's now having to change the way he writes his scripts and his stories. And he didn't really give too much more to it, but I mean, we're certainly seeing from the US the HBO model of a serialized drama where they're starting their production with an end in sight.
Yep.
Which I'm guessing
you mean having a story. Yep.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. Exactly. Yeah. Having a story. Correct. So, but I mean, I'm guessing that's obviously not something Home and Away.
Not something all Australians can do.
No.
Do Australian actors? Does Australian talent in general need validation? Do you think they need to go abroad to make it abroad, to give themselves more confidence that if they do come back home, then they'll be more complete as professional talent?
Come on, like if you make it in America, why would you come back to Australia?
But is it a rite of passage?
Heath Ledger, when he started doing films, he didn't come back to do Home and Away again and go, oh, thank God I'm back at Home and Away. I just feel that everyone likes me now that I've done 10 Things I Hate About You and all those other films that I'm awesome in. That's when you're an actor, you want to do challenging, interesting work. And I think actors are trying to follow where the challenging, interesting work is. Mm. I don't think there's challenging, interesting work in Australia.
You see it with Ryan Kwanten. He goes over to does a season of True Blood, but he does manage to come back. He's made Red Hill. He's made Not Suitable for Children. So maybe he's trying to find a balance.
All those great things you just mentioned about Ryan Kwanten is that the work is great. Mm. The work is interesting. And he's also a producer as well, so he's writing stuff and he's trying to get his own work up as well. So and he wants to make stuff here, he wants to do that here, and he's one of the great leaders of like, I won't say my peer group because I wish I was in that peer group, but he's a whole another standard above me, but he's one of the great leaders of our arts industry now. He's a young fella who wants to take charge and wants to create interesting work and try and make that happen in Australia, and I think that's great. But I think when you're talking about actors not wanting to be on Pack to the Rafters or Sea Patrol or Neighbours or Pack to the Rafters on Channel 9, the one with the bloody barbecue ad and Shane Bourne, come on, let's be serious about the kind of quality of work that people can do. You cannot. It's not an argument about money or validation. I think as artists want to do great work.
Do we have from a writer's perspective?
Yep.
Do we have a problem creating drama in Australia?
I don't think so. I think there's plenty of great drama to be had in Australia. I think we have a problem in funding drama. You want to go to the ABC, put on a show, they'll go, great, oh, great, we'll fund it. We'll fund 30% of this. No problem. We'll just get New South Wales Film Company to drop another 40% in, and we'll get the Screen Australia to drop something in, and we'll get Screen SA to drop something in, and once we get everybody who wants to drop some money in, we'll make a TV show. That's what the problem is, getting shows up.
Yeah, yeah.
Next, sexing up trains and de-drunking kebabs.
This week we covered two PR stories on campaigns aiming to change the perception of brands. Tired of the way they were being perceived. A kebab chain disassociating itself from drunkenness and a state train service wanting to be sexy. The first is Alibaba Kebabs. The chain was has hired PR agency Horizon Communications and brand agency Channel Zero to create a healthy perception of the chain that wasn't a late-night refuge for drunken people. Dan, if you had this account, what would you do? First of all, are you a kebab man at the end of the night or a pie man?
I'm definitely a kebab man.
Okay, so it's your, you know all about it.
I'd get drunk people and rub them in hummus and do a flash mob. Why wouldn't you? Why wouldn't you do that? No, I think it's, I don't know. That's what I would do. I'm going to stick with that. I'm done. I reckon it's good to kind of make kebabs more. Kebabs are healthy, aren't they? They've got meat, veg, dairy when you put yogurt on it.
Lots of
all the five food groups. What's that?
Plenty of vitamin kebab.
Yeah, vitamin kebabs. Yeah.
So Alibaba said it would consider a name change if it came to it. Is the kebab too entrenched in nightclub culture?
I don't think so. Right. I mean, I get kebabs for lunch.
Come from the UK. I mean, perhaps it's a UK sort of thing that come the end of the night, if you haven't found a partner, you'll end up in a kebab house. I mean, it's very much down market, drunk at right at the end of the evening. You can barely walk, but you can walk into a kebab house.
It is a generic trope. Yeah. Dan Kitson has got this great joke about this great observation about the kind of comedy he likes to do. He says, I don't like making obvious jokes. And, you know, saying I get pissed and then grabbing a kebab, that's like an example of a joke. That's just a shit joke because every comic makes that joke. And I don't know. I just think it's just this. I don't know if it's a brand perception problem. I don't know. I don't think like grabbing a kebab means that I'm drunk.
No. I thought that a couple would buy a kebab together and if just leave out the onion if they were planning on.
That's great.
Maybe kebabs need to be
sexed up.
Yeah. Well, kebabs are too easy to eat when you're drunk. That's their problem.
Yeah, they don't.
They're
yeah.
wrapped up and stuff. If you unfold the kebab, this is one of the comments that our readers said was that. To bring out some proper kebab action by de-anglicising the kebab. I don't know what that means, but
I think they were. They were talking about Alibaba kind of playing to an Anglo-Saxon notion of where kebabs come from.
Yeah, I think
Alibaba's magical kebabs. So they should just call it Johnson's kebabs, wouldn't they? That would be better. That's a typically British thing too. The name Johnson. Hello, do you want a kebab? Come around, we're rolling up a kebab. A good family meal.
Meanwhile, the Red Agency Melbourne has been appointed to make Queensland Rail sexy for young travellers. One of our readers said, you are overdressed if you have teeth on Queensland Rail, which we thought was a bit unfair, but there was a lot of talk in the thread on price. Another more rational commenter said, the Europass is 15 countries in 3 months, less than $500. Brisbane to Cairns and back, more than $500. Tough brief. Dan, can you make train travel sexy in the war against, you know, against Richard Branson and his lovely ladies and a flight to Cairns?
I don't think I could. I think when it comes down to train travel, I think it's going to be the product, isn't it? So I think if you make that product better, people are going to use it. And certainly product and price is the first thing that people are going to look at. They're not going to look at brands. Unless you're scared of flying, you're probably not going to take a train. Or if it's cheaper, you definitely would. I've been on long train travel. I've even done the Indian Pacific.
In Australia?
In Pacific, yeah, yeah. Right. I've done Sydney and Melbourne on the train, but I've also done Sydney to Adelaide on the Indian Pacific. And even on the Indian Pacific, it's a bit, come on. It's a bit ho-hum. It's a bit grandmas in retirees just, you know, living the dream of a of train travel. But then again, I've travelled on train in Europe, and it kicks ass because you're just going from place to place.
And they need to bring in the fast trains if they want to compete with
totally.
Airplanes.
Build more places in between.
Yeah, that's true. Make it all about the travel. It is a tough brief indeed, as I said.
Yeah, I mean, it was really convenient to go by train in Europe. It's just not very convenient to go by train in Australia. The places where you want to go in Australia are separated by huge distances, and the trains just don't go fast enough. Like, if there was a TGV in Australia, that'd be awesome. I when Barry O'Farrell's like, oh, we're going to put a fast train into Canberra and make Canberra Sydney's second airport, I'm like, that's a great idea, because that means there's one more length of track before there's a speed train between Sydney and Melbourne. I'd totally catch a fast train in Melbourne, because catching fast train in Europe's awesome. You just rock up and you hop on a train and you go. You don't go through mag and bag and check in your bag and get felled up by fat people with gloves and get your bag checked with explosives by a man who's highly qualified in explosives. There's none of that. You just go.
Yeah.
Better product, please.
Tough brief. Next, the Crows' Alex Proyas might be back in Sydney yet.
There's more to radio than music for your headphones. Radio can connect your brand with consumers in more ways than just over the airwaves. Check out the case study for Nissan MicroCitizen, where listeners were sent to LA, Barcelona and New York to get in sync with the city. Or the interview on how the Lady Gaga deal for Vodafone All-Time Prepaid was done. See that and more at seeradiodifferently.com.
This week brought the news that Alex Proyas, director of The Crow, Dark City and iRobot, will return to Australian shores to direct an adaptation of a 1942 sci-fi novella. Cole, tell us more.
Yeah, so Alex Proyas, he's adapted the screenplay and will direct the adaptation of Robert A. Heinlein's The Unpleasant Profession of Jonathan Hoag. And this news comes just 2 months after it was announced his adaptation of John Milton's epic poem Paradise Lost couldn't get off the ground due to budgetary disputes. Legendary Pictures, the big budget production company behind it, wouldn't foot the full $120 million budget that was needed. But Proyas is a Sydney sider, and he's got a production company down here. So, yeah, reports are that he will bring this film to Sydney. He worked on the screenplay. It'll be co-produced by him and a bunch of reliable US producers, I guess, who are aware of the budget beforehand, before getting all our hopes and all of Sydney's crew and cast getting all their hopes up.
Quite apart from dashing mine at the thought of an adaptation of Milton in the first place, which is frankly anathema. Dan, what are your thoughts on the current state of the film industry?
As a filmmaker, I kind of don't deal with, I don't, the kind of filmmaking I do, I never have to deal with funding bodies or anything like that, because it's all self-funded. And I think the people who are doing great work in Australia are smaller independent filmmakers like Blue Tongue, who are just killing it with their little collective. And I think the stuff that they're doing is so inspiring. I was in Sundance in January, hanging out in Sundance, just checking out a bunch of films, skiing, and then went and saw...
That's unfortunate. That's a shame that you had to do all that.
It is. Yeah. But one of the great things I got to do was hang out with Nash a little bit, and I met Kieran Darcy Smith and hung out with him on the bus going from Nash's short film to another place. So it was great to kind of chat with these guys about kind of their process and stuff. And so it's really cool to see just people making stuff and people trying to get stuff up. And those guys are a huge inspiration, because, like, having been to Sundance, having spoken to those guys, I'm now writing a feature. So it's, like, really exciting. But I don't know anything about the film industry, so I'm very unqualified to talk about it.
But you were sharing an office when you were at Zapruder's with the Distracted Media guys made the tunnel. I think I may have seen you in a couple of scenes drinking at the Rose.
I was in the tunnel and got paid handsomely in beer. Those guys... Those guys are amazing producers, Enzo and Julian. And it's And I see. I don't think Enzo and Julian would count themselves as part of the film industry, because the way they create their work is they disrupt the industry. They don't go through industry channels. It's not like The Tunnel was funded by Screen Australia.
The new film, however,
is, and yeah, they've got a deal with Paramount and all sorts of great stuff because of the work they did before. Mm. So I feel like for those guys, I love people who work outside the system, and those guys are awesome dudes, and I love working with them. And I worked on a lamb ad with them as well. So back in January for Australia Day. So like, those guys are really amazing. They work outside the system, and I feel like they're the people I look to in the industry as people who I think awesome. I love the disruptors, and those guys are definitely doing that.
Wish You Were Here is Kieran Darcy Smith's film.
It's amazing.
Because it opened Sundance.
Yeah.
We haven't seen it yet. It opens on April 26th, I think, or maybe Anzac Day.
Yep.
Without giving too much away, what can you say?
It was the butler with a candlestick in the Bali bar. No, it's an incredible film, and it taps into a lot of conversations that are happening with Australians overseas and Australians doing stupid things in Southeast Asia and things like that. And it's an incredibly gripping story of honesty and truth in a relationship as well. So it's just awesome film. That's why I came back from Sundance so pumped up, having watched Wish You Were Here in a crowded auditorium at Sundance and just seeing the quality of work that was up on the screen. It's just phenomenal. I really hope it kills audiences, and I really hope I really hope audiences find it. I really hope audiences embrace it, because it is a great, great film.
Well, let's, as I said, Wish You Were Here opens on April 26th, but let's do a quick whip around the box office as it stands this weekend over Easter. The Hunger Games pushed on to over $21 million at the local box office in its third week. However, American Pie Reunion's debut topped the ladder this week with $4.8 million. Hunger Games took $3 million this week. Best Exotic Marigold Hotel stayed strong in third place with $2 million. Other new releases, however, was Titanic 3D. Don't know if I need to see it
again in
3D.
I want to see Titanic in 4D, where you get drowned. That would be
you go under. And that took $1.7 million. Pirates Band of Misfits, by the guys that did Wallace and Gromit, took $864,000. Ewan McGregor film Salmon Fishing in Yemen took $567,000. While two Indian films, Houseful 2 and Mirza, The Untold Story, took $239,000 and $142,000 respectively, while the Sean Penn looking like The Cure's Robert Smith in This Must Be the Place took just $72. And $72,000. Sorry.
Poor show. It's indie. It's very indie.
Dan, we may have just touched
on it.
It's
been broadcast as a Word document, so it's very inaccessible as well.
Dan, we may have just touched on it, but have you got a prediction for Australia's biggest box office film this year, this year's Red Dog?
It's going to be Blue Dog. It's a sequel to Red Dog.
It's pretty obscure.
You've probably never heard of it. It's really cool, actually. I hope Wish You Were Here blows up. I reckon that's going to be an awesome Aussie film, and I hope the audiences get to it.
Do you think Australian audiences are turned off by the idea of seeing their own films, or
no,
have they just been burnt by not?
I think Australian audiences are tired of seeing Australian films about drug addict mothers who are from the wrong side of the tracks, who have a heroin addiction. I think that's what Australian audiences are tired of. I think Australian audiences are tired of the boo-hoo Australian story that gets told in 1,000 different Australian films. I think if there's an exciting, engaging Australian film that people really want to see, then, you know, it's about the film.
Do they have to be clichés like Red Dog and like Australia?
No, I don't think so. No. I don't think so at all. not at all. But you, it's going to be a good film. Make a good film.
Yeah. So you want? So you want?
How about that?
Weren't you, you weren't a fan of Snowtown, for example.
A little bit murdery, wasn't it? I haven't seen it, to be honest. I haven't seen Snowtown. I should like to see Snowtown. That would be great.
It took Robin 3 sittings to get through Snowtown.
Really?
And this is a man that likes a murder film.
Yeah, and I do. Since I came to Australia, I
love Wolf Creek. That was an amazing film.
Oh, yeah.
That scared the shit out of me.
Yeah. I mean, Chopper, Bad Boy Bubby.
Chopper's great too.
Yeah. Have you seen Bad Boy Bubby?
No, I haven't.
I highly recommend it.
There are so many great Australian
I've
films.
I've got the DVD. I can loan
it's
you
about
it.
The worst film ever made in Australia.
Look, there's so many great Australian films, and I think the conversation needs to stop being about, people don't want to see Australian films. I think it's got to be, people want to see good films. Let's just make some good films.
Well, that's all we have time for today. We'll leave you with Dan and Brenda McLean's Sydney-sided rendition of The Simpsons monorail song as this city's most retro-futuristic mode of transportation looks doomed. So thanks to Dan.
Pleasure. Good to be with you.
To Kathy.
Thank you.
And to Colin.
Thank you.
The Mumbrella Cast was recorded in the studios of CBS Interactive. See you next week. Ciao for now.
What's going to happen to the monorail?
I heard Hobart wants to buy it.
Oh, that's sad.
A state with money's kind of like a premier with a bike lane. Danged if he knows how he got it, and danged if he knows how to use it.
I come to you with an idea. It's probably the greatest idea.
No, it's actually probably more of a Melbourne idea.
Well, tell us your idea.
Well, instead of telling you our idea,
let's show you.
I've sold monorail to Southbank, SeaWorld, and then Oasis Center Broadbeach, and by gum, it put them on the map.
Well, sir, there's nothing on Earth like a genuine, bona fide, electrified six-car monorail.
What'd he say?
Monorail.
One more time?
Monorail.
I hear those things are awfully light.
Doesn't it just go to Darling Harbour?
Yes, Cockle Bay and Darling Harbour.
What, $9.80 for a day ticket?
Thank the public-private partnership it.
Were you sent here by the devil?
No, sent by Barry O'Farrell.
There's got to be a better plan.
Try my fixie, my good man.
Ah. I swear it's Hobart's only choice.
Throw up your hands and raise your voice.
Monorail.
Tasmania, are you serious, mate?
It's perfect. They're still in 1988.
Monorail.